Nice to see you. How are you feeling today?
Good to meet you, even if just virtually.
Well, you know, there's a lot of virtual going on these days. I'll take it. At least I get to see you and you can see me and we're real people.
Yes.
Well, why don't we get started with you telling us your full name and the years that you went to Swarthmore?
My name is Jack Henry Nagel. I'm from the Swarthmore class of 1966. So I was at the college from September 1962 until May 1966.
All right. So that was a very busy class, very influential. Tell us about your background. Tell us about what was happening for you before you attended school there, how you got there.
Well, I went to high school in West Virginia. Actually, I grew up more in New Jersey near Toms River, but at the end of my sophomore year, my father took a job in Charleston, West Virginia. So my last 2 years of high school were at Stonewall Jackson High School in Charleston. That name, I understand, was changed 2 years ago. But it existed for 60 years, I think more out of state pride than anything, since Stonewall Jackson was born in what's now West Virginia. But at any rate, how I came to Swarthmore, the summer of my junior year, I participated in a summer program at Cornell, the Telluride program. And up till then, I don't think I'd ever heard of Swarthmore, but a lot of there were 16 of us in the program, and a lot of them were interested in Swarthmore. And I think about the same time there was an article in a national magazine, Harper's Magazine. I still remember the title. It was called Eager Swarthmore, and it had a profile in very glowing terms about the college. And I had decided that I wanted to go to a small liberal arts college and that I wanted to go to a co-ed school. There weren't so many co-ed schools back then. And it seemed to me that Swarthmore was the best in that category, at least from the things I was learning then. So I came to know about it quite late. And I only applied to two places, to Swarthmore and to Cornell, because I knew I would be offered a full scholarship at Cornell. I got into Swarthmore, and that all came about.
Well, once you got there, what did you think? Did you get involved in activism fairly quickly?
Well, when you say once you got there, I remember the first time I set foot on campus, other than for an interview I'd had, and I thought I was in paradise. The campus was so beautiful, and so I was very happy with that setting. But as for activism, no, I didn't get, as far as I remember, and this is going back almost 60 years, the first really deep involvement I had was in 1964 in the presidential election campaign then. There may have been some things before that, but I wasn't involved more. I should say I was a political science major, and most political scientists and political science majors, I think, were more standard liberal Democrats rather than radicals. And rather than activists in unconventional ways, there was a lot of complacency in the political science profession back then about American institutions, still is to some degree. So there was an orientation toward normal electoral processes and acceptance that the system could be made to work well. There were a lot of course, people at Swarthmore who were more radical point of view, who went into less conventional forms of activism.
So tell us about your 1964 engagements with the presidential election at the time. What was happening for you?
Yeah, well, there was an organization called Young Citizens for Johnson Humphrey. Many of us were very worried about the Goldwater candidacy, more, I think, on foreign policy grounds than anything else, although his clear appeal to states' rights was also very disturbing in the wake of the March on Washington and the big move for civil rights legislation. But we also felt that he was dangerous and that he might use nuclear weapons. Many of us were very scared of that. So I was on the steering committee of Young Citizens for Johnson Humphrey. And I was the author of an appeal to students to volunteer for the campaign. And I have to confess, I put it in pretty melodramatic terms, you know, that we had to convince people that their efforts were important because all indications were that Johnson was going to win. And so people then say, well, who needs to really worry about it? And so we said, well, maybe Johnson will win, but look what's at stake. This guy could basically blow up the world. Not those exact terms, but something. And we put out, I think, a mailing in everybody's mailbox. I think we probably did that. And we got a lot of volunteers. We had very many students. Not sure exactly, but I coordinated a phone bank that was run in conjunction with the AFL-CIO in Delaware County. And we turned out students on election day and before to make calls through the phone bank that was set up by the labor union. And I remember the day quite vividly because I was in political science honors at that time. It was the fall of my junior year. And I was in a political theory seminar with Roland Penick, and or the professor Roland Penick. And we would never think of cutting a seminar, even if it was election day. And even if I was responsible for coordinating an awful lot of volunteers, the number pops into my head is 140, but I don't know if that's right or not. So I got Professor Penick's permission to use his house phone. Of course, there were no cell phones back then, just before the seminar and during the seminar break. Seminars generally ran for about 5 hours, and we would have a 20 or 30 minute break where his wife served a marvelous tea. And I spent all that time on the phone fighting fires about, you know, what needed to be done to coordinate the campaign effort.
And so as you continued with that effort, do you have any exciting stories to tell us? Did you all go to the convention? Did you do any protest in support for Humphrey?
Before that effort, which was around election day, the summer before I'd gone back to West Virginia, I should say my family moved from West Virginia right after about the time I started at Swarthmore. And so while I was at Swarthmore, they were living near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. My dad had taken a job there. But I went back to West Virginia for the summer after my sophomore year and worked in an anti-poverty program of one of the early community action agencies. And my father, when he was in West Virginia, had helped organize that agency. It was called Action for Appalachian Youth. And I got the summer internship because of that connection. And I worked with a community action outreach worker, the principal area. I worked if you know the topography of Appalachia, a lot of people live up hollers, we call them. And my family lived in a holler when we were there on the outskirts of Charleston. But the work I was assigned was in a predominantly Black neighborhood that was up another holler on the other side of the city. Population of Charleston was probably only about 10% Black then, but and the follow-up to that, those of us who were interns did go to Washington, and to meet with officials. And there I met a classmate of mine in high school who was working for a member of Congress, and she was going to go to the convention in Atlantic City. So at the end of the summer, I went to mainly to see her, but observed a lot on the boardwalk, including the sit-ins by the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and a lot that was going around the edges of the convention. And that helped to, I was already very interested in politics, but the dramatic stakes that were evident there, along with the Goldwater candidacy, got me very deeply involved in the next fall.
Did you get involved in civil rights activism? Did you go to any of the sit-ins or protests that were happening in like Cambridge or Chester, or even, I don't think anything was going on in West Virginia at the time, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, of course, that summer, I don't recall any civil rights work. This would be the summer of 64. I'm not sure what was the first demonstration I was in, but when I came back home at the end of the summer job, back to my family home in New Cumberland, across the river from Harrisburg. And I watched the March on Washington on TV, and I felt terribly upset that I hadn't been there. I wished that I had been there. And the next weekend of March was organized in Harrisburg. So I participated in that march. I'm not sure if that was the first civil rights demonstration or not. There was one when I was at Swarthmore at college, and the campaign in Chester was going on. There was to be a demonstration one night, beginning in one of the African American churches in Chester, and I went to that more out of curiosity than anything else, because I wasn't part of the Student Political Action Committee or SDS. I wasn't sure I fully subscribed with their tactics or what they were doing, but I went. It was a very dramatic event. I was sitting up in the balcony, and there was a very large crowd of both Chester residents and students. And then after the rally in the church, there was a march in the streets, and I got swept up in that and joined in it. And I can't remember if that was before or after the march in Harrisburg. Might have been before, but I wasn't a civil rights activist as a primary thing. The main involvement that I had was more an outgrowth of the concern with inequality and racial discrimination that had become to the fore both through the civil rights movement and then through the war on poverty, which was much more than just about poverty among Black people. Coming from West Virginia, I knew there was a lot of poverty among white people in Appalachia and elsewhere. So I got involved in the summer after my junior year. I took a job as a counselor in what was then called the Swarthmore Wade House Summer Program. And Wade House was a settlement house in Chester. And I'm not quite sure how the alliance originated between Swarthmore College and the Wade House, but there was a summer program organized to bring students mostly from Chester to campus to have an intensive academic educational experience. And I think it had existed before. I'm not quite sure how I got involved. My memory was that my very good friend, John Morrow, have you talked with John, or is he on your list?
I am trying to speak with John Morrow. I actually have his contact information. He's awfully kind of busy with, I think he just put out a book. Yeah. But I'm going to try again to please get him to talk to me.
Well, after our interview, I'll tell him I talked with you and encourage him to.
Please do. Please do.
Anyway, my memory was that John had recruited me for the Upward Bound or Waite House program, but he says, no, it was the other way around. The next summer, both of us were counselors, and he says, I recruited him to be a counselor after our senior year. And what he recruited me to be was a proctor in the Mary Lyons dorm. The proctors were the students who kept things orderly and handled student problems. And we're supposed to enforce the rules, although we didn't actually, just made sure people weren't violating them in a way that upset other people in the dorm. At any rate, so the program, as I said, provided an educational experience for young people, mostly from Chester, and I think they were all African-American, or some maybe mixed race. As I mentioned, it was a forerunner of the Upward Bound program. And in fact, the following year, my senior year, I went to Washington with Gilmore Stott. Do you know of Gilmore Stott?
No.
Gil Stott was sort of assistant to President Smith. And he kind of handled all kinds of things. And he was an institution at Swarthmore then and for many years after. It's part of the, I'm sure he was a Quaker himself and a very, very fine man. There was a small delegation of us, Gil Stott and Chuck Gilbert, Charles Gilbert, who was my professor in political science. Chuck is still alive, living in a retirement community nearby, although I understand he's not doing too well, some dementia and problems, but he was an outstanding professor. I took a couple of seminars with him and learned a great deal from him. And the three of us, I'm not sure if there was anyone else, went down to meet with people at what was just founded, the Office of Economic Opportunity, to explore funding for our little Swarthmore Waite House summer program and to tie it into the Upward Bound program, which would be that kind of thing on a national scale. And I remember that our model that we were following was really quite different from what the OEO people had in mind. First of all, ours was not a residential program. Their idea was to take kids away from their home environment and get them out onto a college campus and all the distractions and influences in their home neighborhoods, they'd be cut off from that. And we felt, well, we're only 3-4 miles from Chester. We can easily bring kids back and forth, and they're gonna have to go back into their neighborhoods after the summer's over. So we have to have a way to connect what they learn and the habits and values that we help them develop and how to maintain those back home. So part of our program is in the summer, we would go have visits with the family. We drove a van back and forth to pick up the kids and take them home at night. Another way we were different is that the Upward Bound program was aiming for kids senior high, 16, 17 year old level, about to launch into college. Excuse me just a second. I've got
sure.
Vic, I'm on this interview doing renovations. Sorry, we were having renovations done in our house, and the contractor and his guys are downstairs, and I told him I was going to be in an interview and shouldn't be interrupted, but he's kind of hard of hearing, and he forgot, I guess. Sorry about that.
Not a problem.
So the other difference was rather than have kids at late stage in high school, ours were 13, 14, 15. We wanted to get to them early and then have them come back repeated summers so that we'd have that continuing influence. So anyway, I think the Upward Bound people decided to make an exception for us and that program got funding. And I was a counselor again in the summer of 1966 after I'd graduated after my senior year. Following 1965, my junior year, with this idea of connecting what happened in the summer program to life back in Chester, we organized a tutoring program for all of the kids who had been in the summer program, but also for as many others as we could get tutors for as well. And this was a very large scale too. I don't remember the number on that either, but we had a lot of tutors from the college who would meet at least weekly with the tutee and sometimes more often. We had a study center set up in a building adjacent, I think, to a church where tutors and tutees could meet. The tutors frequently brought their tutees out to the college, maybe to have a meal or something. In fact, that's how I got involved with my first wife, because she was a classmate and she was a tutor in the program. But even though we were classmates, we hadn't really got to know each other. But because of her involvement in this program, things took off very fast. And we got married right after we graduated. But the marriage didn't last too long, 10 years, but produced two kids. But anyway, that's another story. So this tutoring program was a very time-consuming involvement because I was the main coordinator of it in my senior year when I was in honors as well. And so partly because of that, I gave up track, which I had run in always in the past. I also felt I'd sort of plateaued in my running time, so I wasn't so motivated to continue the senior year. So that was my main kind of involvement. They were either in conventional electoral politics, as in 1964, or in these efforts to help bring about greater equality and greater opportunity through kind of anti-poverty efforts and working with kids, but not just one-on-one. I was helping to organize things for people.
Who were some of the people you worked with in the Chester area to get the program started?
Well, I didn't get the program started. It was already going on when I became a counselor. I don't remember the people in Chester specifically that we had involvement with. I remember our director who was hired for the summer, his man named Don Cheeks, who was a psychologist, PhD psychologist. And he was a very dynamic, charismatic leader for the program, both years that I was involved. And he helped us. I think he taught at Temple at that time, but I'm not sure. He had a big influence on me in both the junior and senior year summers, and a big influence in shaping the program. But I think he was actually from Philadelphia that worked with us in Chester. Now, some of the people who we taught in the program went on to have an impact in Chester. And there's jumping ahead a long way. My wife, we've been married 40 years, but she was not the Swarthmore classmate. It was my wife. Barbara got involved 5 years ago in a group called Chester East Side. She coordinates a community garden in Chester East Side and runs, it's mainly educational opportunity for the children in Chester East Side. And Chester East Side is a service program that provides food bank, it provides after school educational program, a summer educational program, very much the kinds of things that we were trying to do in a different format. Well, the founder and longtime director of Chester East Side is a woman named Bernice Warren, who was an ordained Presbyterian minister. But I first knew Bernice Warren as a 13-year-old student in the Swarthmore Wade House study program.
Oh, wow.
So she went on to go to college, become a minister, and went back to Chester and organized organized the Chester East Side ministry. Originally, it was under the aegis of the Presbyterian Church, but it's since spun off. And Bernice died maybe 3 or 4 years ago of cancer. And so her successor as director, Reverend Zelene Wilkinson, is the person who recruited my wife, Barbara, to get involved that way. Reverend Wilkinson resigned earlier this year, so they're in an interregnum, but the efforts are still continuing. So I thought that was kind of a small world thing, and that my wife got so involved in a program that had its beginnings with a skinny little girl who was I worked with in those 2 summers.
What did you tutor?
Well, we would tutor whatever they were working on in school and whatever they needed help with, because it wasn't where they were juniors or seniors, maybe doing advanced math or biology or physics or chemistry. And my tutee in the academic year needed a lot of help with basic things of arithmetic, you know, advanced arithmetic, and whatever he was trying to do on his homework, I would help him with. Now, in the summer program, we had a much more systematic educational setup. I think we had 16 counselors who had a variety of majors, and we also had athletic activities. One of our kids, Don Cheeks, was himself an outstanding track athlete, or had been in his younger days, and both John Morrow and I were track athletes. And we had a kid, we organized a sort of field day where the kids could, you know, run. And there was this one fellow named Bruce Collins, and we saw him run and we said, oh my, you know, he was so fast. And he later went on to Penn, the University of Pennsylvania, and was one of the really outstanding track athletes. And I don't know, I can't say we discovered him, because anybody who saw him run would know immediately that he was a really major talent, but certainly we encouraged it and could do that, particularly Don, who was an outstanding athlete himself.
Did you meet any of the civil rights activists who might be helping with arranging protests or arranging any kind of actions going on in Chester?
I don't know that I met personally. I was aware of, you know, people like Stanley Branch, and I'm sure I heard some speak at the rally I attended, but I was not directly involved.
So your group didn't really receive any training from any people like, you know, Branch trained some people and Gloria Richardson trained some people and this and that, but you all didn't get any of that?
No, because we weren't engaged in civil disobedience or protest demonstrations. Ours was an ameliorative kind of effort to help people as individuals, although, you know, a lot of individuals.
Did you ever go to any of the Swarthmore, or any of the Friends summer work camps, or get involved in any of their activities?
No.
Did you find the Swarthmore philosophy of peace and you know, Quakerism influential to you in any way?
Well, yes and no. I think the Quaker tradition permeated the college, even though most of us as students were not members of the Society of Friends, although maybe we were attracted there. I always thought my mother was not a Quaker. She's actually Australian and Anglican brought up, but I always felt she was like a Quaker in her personality, and there was maybe that compatibility that a lot of students had. And of course, then there was a significant minority who were raised as Quakers. But certainly that tradition in peace activism and activism for human rights was very important. But one of the events that had a huge impact on me occurred in the Friends Meeting House, which we occasionally was used for college-wide events. They didn't have so much other spaces of that sort then. And this was teaching about the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. which was in the spring of my senior year, 1966. And up to that time, I had not really been anti-war. Many people in the college were anti-war. But we political science majors sort of prided ourselves in being tough-minded and realpolitik and all that sort of stuff. So I said, you know, war is awful, but sometimes it's necessary and so forth. Well, at this teach-in, a number of the faculty spoke. And the one who made a huge impression on me was Kenneth Waltz, who was a professor of international relations and foreign policy, and I had had him for a seminar. And Waltz became a very famous figure in political science. He went on from Swarthmore first to Columbia, then to Berkeley, had a huge impact on the whole study of international relations, and served as president of the American Political Science Association. But at this time, he was relatively early in his career, and he was not at all Quakerly. He was very tough-minded, realpolitik kind of person. Nothing like the pacifists that, you know, you might associate with Quakerism. It wasn't Quaker. Well, in this teach-in, he gave this coldly lucid, dispassionate demolition of all the arguments in favor of our being involved in Vietnam. And it was so compelling coming from somebody who was not a bleeding heart, you know, Quakerly liberal. And it undermined all the sort of tough-minded rationales, I said, why the war would be necessary. And so then all you had left was the pain and the horrible suffering that Vietnamese people and American soldiers and were going through. So that led to my becoming a very strong opponent of the Vietnam War. Not so much when I was at Swarthmore, but very soon after I went to Yale for a PhD program. And at Yale, I became one of the organizers of the Yale Draft Refusal Committee, which was a We Won't Go group, one of the first of those groups. And we circulated a leaflet and a pledge form where students would say that if they were drafted, they would refuse induction, which meant potentially up to 5 years in prison. The initial round of signatures, we had 300 and some signatures, and coming from Yale, which was an establishment kind of organization, that was a pretty big deal. And later more and more signed it. So I became very much of a activist in the anti-war movement when I was in New Haven, and participated in many demonstrations and other activities like the Draft Refusal Committee. And also in New Haven, I became involved in local electoral politics. And there was an alliance between anti-war liberals, mostly white, but not all, and the insurgent Black community in New Haven. I think it was in 1969, the first serious Black candidate for mayor, a man named Henry Parker, ran for mayor. So I was very involved in his campaign. A very good friend of mine was his campaign manager, and so I became sort of part of the inner circle of that campaign in the Democratic primary. Parker lost, but it was a very good effort. And as a result of that campaign and some follow-up campaigns, that alignment won a number of seats in the Connecticut legislature and in the Board of Aldermen and had a substantial impact. So at Yale, I was there for 5 years, and I'd say I spent at least half my time actually doing politics rather than just studying politics. And the two things were the anti-war movement and the the insurgent politics, principally in support of Hank Parker, but also other candidates.
So you sound as though you are one who moved from, a lot of students have made note of moving from a real focus on civil rights to a focus on the anti-war movement. A number of them have indicated that that shift in focus was a fairly, you might say, natural thing after the two major pieces of legislation passed in 64 and 65. Whereas you sound as you were one who went from a different sort of volunteer activism to the anti-war movement in a, on a different pathway than your fellow students.
Yeah, well, after the victories of 64 and 65 with and the Voting Rights Act in 65, that to me already involved in electoral politics, that pointed to electoral politics as the thing to do. But the other thing, which was a bit more personal, I had worked so hard to elect President Johnson, and then he leads us astray. In fact, he was the peace candidate in 64. That was a big part of why I and many others worked for him. And instead of bringing peace to Vietnam, he brought escalation and thousands of casualties. And so by 66, 67, the war was all consuming for those of us, as we had to directly decide whether we would serve. In my senior year at Swarthmore, I was called up for a physical exam, along with a lot of other Swarthmore students, and we were summoned to the induction center in Philadelphia. And I remember that pretty vividly because two of us were a bit insubordinate. They had some regular military people who were telling us what to do, and they were getting their jollies out of ordering around college boys and you know, treating us as if we were already in basic training. And we were an odd pair, the two of us who resisted that. One was Phil Barley, who was the president of our class and a very straight arrow kind of guy. And then me, and we spoke back a bit to this guy who was being authoritarian. And so he held us back when everybody else finished, and we were detained there for a while until he let us go. I mean, he had no reason to hold us. But at any rate, as a result of that exam, I was classified 1A. So I knew that if I got called up, I would not have an excuse. Now, I went to Yale. I got a student deferment, but the deferments were that program was phased out because so many people were evading the draft using them. So it was a realistic question, would you go? And so we had to confront that, and having confronted that I would not, and then I tried to, well, I won't make much difference as an individual, but if there are a lot of us who say we won't go, maybe we can have an impact. And I think part of it also, of course, Martin Luther King in those years gave more and more attention to the Vietnam War. And we saw it as derailing the U.S. from all the progress that had been made in both civil rights and the anti-poverty programs, and instead putting the resources into a war. At any rate, that was my major focus in 1966, 67, 68. And I was in many demonstrations, although never practicing civil disobedience. By 1969, my wife and I had a small baby. We took him at the age of 6 months to the big march in Washington in November 1969. And three of us got tear gassed.
Oh no.
Which was not a good thing to have with a 6-month old on your back. And we hadn't planned to get into that situation. It just, things got out of control and they started firing tear gas. And we were shut off from the bus that had brought us down. And unfortunately, there was a cab driver passing, and we hailed him down, and he took pity on us and drove us to Union Station so we could get out of that and get our baby out of that. But I didn't go there to get tear gas or none of the violent efforts that some of our classmates got swept up in. I mentioned, you probably know of Kathy Wilkerson.
Yes, but I don't know as much as you're going to tell me, so please tell me.
No, I don't know that much either, but she, of course, became famous or infamous because of the explosion in Greenwich Village townhouse that was owned by her father. And she had become part of the Weather Underground and had turned to violence against the war. But I didn't know Kathy in a personal way or wasn't close, but there was a demonstration that I participated in at the college. I think, you know, we had a collection in those days. Every Thursday morning, there would be everybody was required to attend collection, which was an assembly of the whole school. And usually there would be speakers. And I think at one of these, they had a speaker representing South Africa, maybe the ambassador from South Africa. So a lot of us picketed to protest that. And there was a big banner against apartheid. And I think I was holding up one end of it and Kathy Wilkerson was holding up the other. And that may have appeared in the Phoenix, the campus paper. But I didn't think much of it at the time. She was just holding the banner and I was holding the banner. But then when she had gone, became so radicalized that she got involved in making bombs and was for a long time a fugitive. And I was thinking, there we were both in the same cause and a nonviolent, you know, peaceful picket kind of thing. But and I got very much into the anti-war movement, but never would have thought of, you know, days of rage or bombing or vandalism or things like that. Although I think I could understand the frustration that people felt. All of us did.
It was a very frenetic, insane period of time. And I could understand how different factions broke off to do the kinds of over the top things that occurred, because it seemed the system was breaking down, or its ability to address people's concerns was breaking down so rapidly. And this also seems like one of the starkest periods where the masses understood that our leaders would not only could, but would tell us lies. And so, you know, from that, I can understand how some people just really had it. It's definitely not the way to go, as we can look at where we are right now and see that that's the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Well, before I ask you this final question, are there any other experiences you'd like to share about your activist work that are, whether to the side or in the middle or what have you, are there any other stories you'd like to share before we talk about how you feel about where you are now compared to where you had been?
You know, when I originally thought maybe you were looking for more of the activists in the SPAC or SDS group, and you told me you weren't, but we were very aware of their activities. The demonstrations and the movement in Cambridge and so on, you know, were often major stories in the campus paper, and it was a big deal what was going on there, Cambridge and in Chester, and other civil rights activities. But many of us didn't, you know, were more conventional. I wasn't. Some people were apolitical, but I certainly wasn't, but I was in more conventional kind of politics. and this is kind of maybe a side light, but as I mentioned, political science at that time was kind of a complacent profession when it came to views of American institutions and how democracy could work. The more radical students were either in the humanities or sometimes natural sciences, or they looked to the discipline of sociology. And there was no sociology department at Swarthmore back then. Do you know this story?
I don't know if I know that story. I know there's no sociology department, but tell me your story.
Wasn't one back then. I think there is one now.
Yes.
So the radicals in academia tended to be sociologists, and many of them had a very strong critique of so-called power elite. C. Wright Mills was the best known. He wrote a book called The Power Elite. And it was not so sanguine a view of American institutions as political scientists tend to have. And it was a very big debate in academia. My first book was about that, about the analysis of power and figuring out what the distribution was. So a lot of the students thought that Swarthmore ought to have a sociology department. Well, the student council had a fund of money that they could use as they wished. They decided to hire the Penn Sociology Department to come give a series of lectures through one semester. So once a week, a Penn sociologist, a different one each week, would come and give a lecture about their area of research. And in the first couple of lectures, there was huge attendance. And then it dwindled off as people, well, it's a boring academic lecture after all. But that sort of shamed the administration, that there seemed to be so much demand from the students that the student council would put the money into that. And so they decided to create a Department of Sociology and Anthropology, and they did. And that wasn't altogether a political cause, but I think a lot of it was that sociology was the social science discipline that appealed to the more radical students.
Some of whom went and studied sociology at other colleges during this period of time. So that's a very interesting story, and I'm glad you shared it. Well, the final question I ask to everyone is to give me your assessment of something between what you think happened and how effective you think you were given what you were doing in the 60s versus where we are today. You know, many people had a lot of radical work. Some people had a lot of behind the scenes building work to establish fair communities and this and that. But what do you think about it now that we are where we are today?
I'll give you a roundabout answer, if you don't mind.
Feel free.
My activism against the Vietnam War, and particularly the draft refusal movement, led to my becoming an academic. Because when I went to Yale, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to go into government. I wouldn't have ever gone into electoral politics, but myself as a candidate. But government and politics or into academic political science. And it's a bit of a complicated story, but I decided at Yale that if I had gone the governmental route, I probably would have chosen to go to law school after a year in a master's program at Yale. But the other route would be a PhD in related to political science. And after putting my name out in line as somebody who would refuse the draft, and I actually was the spokesman for the draft refusal committee, so when there was a press conference, I was the one who, you know, fielded the questions and gave the, so I was on camera. In fact, my future father-in-law My wife recalls him being furious at this Yaley who doesn't appreciate, you know, the good things of this country and so on. He didn't know it was to become his son-in-law many years later. And so I decided I would go into academia. Now, maybe I would have anyway, but that shaped all the rest of my career. And because I'd been observed so much of participatory movements, and of course, participatory democracy was the slogan of SDS, and many of us were involved in participation in different ways. After I wrote this very abstract and technical treatise on power as my first book, my second book was aimed at students and it was called Participation. And it brought together things I'd learned as a social scientist with things I had observed as an activist or seeing classmates at Swarthmore and Yale getting involved in things. So I'm not sure how much impact that book had, not as much as I would have liked, but it certainly shaped my career then. But in the later, well, really since the 1980s, I became more aware of how our institutions shape the outcomes. And this has become very dramatically evident with Trump winning only because of the Electoral College, or George Bush only winning because of the Electoral College, or gerrymandering, or the bias of the Senate towards small states. And since I was very interested in elections, but I didn't get swept up very much in political behavior, what voters do, I looked at the electoral rules. So I've done a lot of work on alternative electoral systems and electoral reforms. That's very hard to achieve because the people who were elected under the existing system don't want to change the rules that they win by. But it did happen sort of miraculously in New Zealand when I happened to be there on a Fulbright, and they had a radical change in their electoral system to a proportional system. So I wrote a lot about that and studied it and made a couple return visits and tried to bring that reform to the attention of American political scientists and activists to say it is possible to actually change an electoral system for the better. It doesn't happen very often, and I tried to explain exactly what was the recipe, what enabled it to succeed in New Zealand. And because of that, I got involved in a national reform group that's now called Fair Vote. It was previously Citizens for Voting and Democracy, or Committee for Voting and Democracy. So even in retirement, I've continued to be an advisor, often informal, sometimes on a paid basis too. And in fact, after our interview, I have a Zoom meeting with a advisory group for Fair Vote on the system they use in New Zealand. It's called mixed member proportional, and how that might be used in American states. So I've continued to be involved both in my academic research and then in the payoff of that in helping to search for better ways of doing things in the US, even though it's a long shot and a difficult effort, but hopefully we can make some improvements. And a completely unexpected kind of involvement has been in the League of Women Voters. Shortly after I retired, a couple years after, I wrote an op-ed for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and somebody in the local league saw it and asked me to give a talk on it, and so I did. And after that talk, they asked me, would I like to join, participate in the league? I said, I didn't know men were allowed. they said, yes, men have been allowed for some time. They'd had a big debate about changing the name of the organization, but it had such a strong brand that they didn't. So I joined the league in 2014 and have been active mostly in the local chapter, but also at state conventions and once at a national convention. mainly promoting understanding of alternative electoral reforms on districting, stopping gerrymandering, on reform of the Electoral College that would have made Trump's victory not happen. So that's kept me somewhat involved, both working in the league and working for Fair Vote a bit in retirement.
How do you think they did in New York last year with the new voting system that they tried that sounds very much like what you just described?
Yeah, it is one of the reforms that Fair Vote has advocated. And one of the things that I did for them was review a report that they put out about the New York experience. They have a lot of young people, interns and recent graduates who do research studies, and the paid work I do for them is to critique those work, you know, sort of like a professor might say, well, here, got that wrong, or improve this or that. So I did that for their report. But they didn't heed the main advice I gave them. What they wanted to prove was that the reform, it's called ranked choice voting, mm-hmm. or it's called instant runoff voting. They wanted to prove that that reform was favorable to minority candidates. And they looked at the actual outcomes, and a lot of minority candidates were elected under it in New York, and the same system's been used in San Francisco and a lot of California cities and Minneapolis, some other places. But Eric Adams had opposed the system. And my argument to the Fair Vote people was that Eric Adams had been right in that in the situation in New York, it is not really helpful to a minority candidate who represents a substantial minority of the population. Mm-hmm. The Black population is not a majority of New York City, but it's a substantial minority. And the whole idea of this instant runoff system is to ensure that the winner is supported by a majority. So under the old plurality rules, an Eric Adams who could get 35-40% of the vote in a multi-candidate field would win as the plurality winner. But with the transfers, you have to get up to 50%. And if voting is really polarized on racial lines, that would shut out the minority candidate. That's the similar system of regular runoffs where you come to the polls twice is used in a lot of southern states, Georgia, Louisiana.
I live in Georgia.
Okay, well, the original goal of that was to prevent Black victories. Mm-hmm. Now, it didn't work that way for Reverend Warnock. And if the voting is not too polarized on racial lines, then that can be okay, because Warnock got a lot of white votes, and Asian votes, and so on. And similarly, in New York City, it wasn't totally polarized, but as the transfers of this ranked choice voting went on, his lead shrank, because the main opponents had agreed to swap transfers. And so their vote kept rising as candidates were eliminated. He still managed to win, but he was right in thinking it was to his disadvantage. And I argued that Fair Vote had to confront that problem. Now, if you had a situation in a majority Black city, it would definitely help Black candidates, because it's designed to prevent a group's votes from being split. Instead, they can be basically transferred and shared. But they didn't really want to approach that. And it's the difference between an academic who, you know, you call it the way you see it, or an advocacy group that is trying to push a particular reform. And it's a good reform, but the particular argument they were making doesn't always hold. It holds in some situations and not others.
Well, I thank you very much for that comment and for your unique commentary about your experiences at Swarthmore. They will go marvelously into this group of interviews and transcripts. Now, I will be, of course, sending you a thank you for your efforts. And the interview will go into the transcription process, and then the library staff will be deciding, and I believe probably Tom Webb, since he's a major proponent of this project, will decide exactly how they're going to put it up. But I am pretty much done with interviews at this point, with the exception of anyone that can be brought forward, like John Morrow would be wonderful. I only have, I think, a couple more. Sorry about that. Time to take a pill. You probably know about that too. At any rate, I really thank you very much for your time today. And if you can send your friend a note, that would make me very, very thrilled. And by all means, email me if you have any questions or any suggestions that you would like me to know about.
Well, I would certainly be very curious to see either transcripts or, better yet, the videos of your interviews with some of my classmates and other people I knew. So, but I guess I can find out about that from Tom.
Well, as soon as they come up, I am now going into transcription mode. So I'm going to be transcribing, I think I have 16, 18 interviews. Yeah, it's a big job. And I only have until basically the beginning of August when I go back to school to work on this. So the next couple of months, I'll be transcribing as fast as possible.
Well, I appreciate your efforts. It will be of great interest to those of us from those days. And to think back has been enjoyable for me. So I will get in touch with John and encourage him to have an interview. His perspective would be very interesting. I don't know how much people
have talked. I would love to have it. Love to have it.
Yeah. Well, you need to take your meds, and maybe you have other things to do, but I could talk about the internal politics of Black students at Swarthmore in those days.
Oh, I wish you would.
Well, just a very brief thing. I don't know exactly the full history of discrimination, but there certainly hadn't been many Black students until that period. And in my class, there were maybe 6 or 8 Black students. I don't know the exact number, but they tended to be children of the elite. And John's father was a professor and had been the first African-American ambassador appointed by the United States in the Eisenhower administration. He was ambassador to Guinea. And the Lawrence sisters, Sarah Lawrence and her sister Paula, who was a year behind us, and very, you know, they came from outstanding privileged backgrounds. Now, there were a few Black students who came from Philadelphia public high schools and the like, but there were not many Black students. And what happened in the 60s is there was a real rise of militancy. You probably know about that sit-in, heart attack of Courtney Smith and all that. And John was a much less militant, although, you know, committed to the same causes, but his tactics and means would have been different. And he, I think, as an alumnus, spoke out against the sit-ins. And he's a very frank and very outspoken guy with a lot of courage. And his perspective on all of this would be very interesting.
Yes, I would love to have it. Absolutely love to have it. So hopefully he will give us an interview. Give him my number by email.
I hope he will.
I hope so too.
He owes me one. I called the attention of the alumni magazine to his winning a big award from the Pritzker Foundation in Chicago. And so they wrote a story about him. So now he can give back.
Well, thank you for your efforts. And on that note, I will say good afternoon, enjoy yourself, and best wishes with your household renovations.
Thank you, Melissa. Very enjoyable to talk with you, and good luck with your project.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.